Hello and welcome to this bonus episode of the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia. And today I'm very pleased to be bringing you a podcast episode that explores the latest developments in RET-driven lung cancer that were presented at the American Society of Clinical Oncology, or ASCO, 2021 virtual conference. The session has been sponsored by an educational grant from Eli Lilly and is hosted by Dr. Bridget Scott, a freelance medical writer from MyAS Editorial Services. Sharing their findings from ASCO are two great speakers. First, we have Dr. Maximilian Hochmeier from the Department of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine at Karl Landsteiner Institute for Lung Research and Pulmonary Oncology in Vienna, Austria. You will also hear from Dr. Fernando López Ríos from the Pathology Department at the Hospital Universitario 12 de Octubre in Madrid, Spain. They discuss the importance of the RET gene, review latest efficacy and safety data, and explore what these developments could mean for the treatment of RET-driven lung cancer in the future. It's a cracker of a conversation, so please do settle in and enjoy.
Hello and welcome to the podcast, Dr. Maximilian Hochmeier and Dr. Fernando López Ríos. So let's start with a background question. What is the RET gene? How significant was its discovery? And what is the importance of this gene in lung cancer? Max, would you like to start us off?
So we learned that lung cancer is not lung cancer. The first was the EGFR mutation, where we learned that patients who have lung cancer need a special treatment in an EGFR mutation, that we should treat these patients with pills in this situation. Now we have EGFR, ALK, ROS1, MET skipping mutations, so the group of different biomarkers and receptors that we can better treat is increasing. And also RET is now the focus, where we know that when we find this RET mutation, RET fusion, or RET receptor, we can target this treatment especially on this receptor and treat these patients much, much better in comparison to the older times. Fernando, how would you answer this question?
Well, I completely agree with you, Max. Thank you. For me, the arrival of RET fusions in the field of lung cancer biomarker testing, it's kind of the tipping point for making everyone understand that we need comprehensive profiling for all of our advanced lung cancer patients. I mean, if we look at the structure, the gene is located on chromosome 10, the long arm. It's composed of 20 exons, and it's very, very similar to that of other receptor tyrosine kinases. So we know the extracellular domain, the intracellular domain, but what we need to find those 1% to 2% of lung cancer patients with fusions because of the amazing clinical results that are being presented and that we see in the clinic. So I guess, Max, that's your field, and I will also like to hear more about it in the following questions.
Fantastic, thank you. So what is meant by RET fusion positive non-small cell lung cancer? And are there specific clinical challenges in the management of these patients?
So we know that, like Fernando said already, that 1 till 2% of our patients have this RET fusion. There are no clinical signs in the patient's characteristic that we know that this patient will have a RET fusion. To see if the patient has a RET fusion and will have a clear efficacy of a RET inhibitor, to know that we need a test, we need a histological test. We do reflex NGS testing in our patients to detect this RET fusion in our patients. And we know that chemotherapy is not working that well in these patients. So it's necessary that we really know if the patient has a RET fusion already initially to plan the best treatment for these patients in non-small cell lung cancer in stage 4. Fernando, what do you mean?
I think you are absolutely right. For us, it's a huge challenge when we're looking at a 1% to 2% incidence not to miss a patient. So in the ideal world, the best would be to have reasonably large NGS panel performed on all of our advanced lung cancer patients. One very important thing is to make sure that the panel, that the NGS panel, contains most of the RET fusions that are actionable, because we have good news, great clinical results, but bad news is that RET is rearranged with many different partners. So from testing standpoint, this is sometimes very challenging. So we need to make sure that the NGS panel is broad enough. And also a very, I think, important consideration is to make sure if we are using a DNA-only NGS panel and we get a result back that is negative, we need to make sure that we confirm a negative result with an RNA-based NGS approach. And I think this is also true for other actionable fusions, not only for RET. Of course, we can also use FISH to look for this 1-2% of advanced lung cancer patients. But there are several lines of evidence that indicate that RET FISH, even using break apart probes, can be challenging to interpret. So I'm now very happy that we have RET in the biomarker portfolio, because I think it's helping us convince everyone that we need more NGS in our patients with lung cancer.
So what is really, Fernando, thank you for your point, especially for separating between DNA and RNA testing. And one of our first patients one of the patients was in the DNA NGS negative for RET, and then we sent them a specimen to Foundation One. At this time, we didn't do RNA testing. And then we saw that in the RNA testing, the patient, one of the first patients we had with selpercatinib, that this patient was RET fusion positive and was leading to a clear treatment. Fernando, thank you for the advice, DNA and RNA testing in NGS. That helps a lot.
Yeah, that's a great story, Max, because and also another thing that I would like to emphasize is that if we are doing single gene testing and we run, let's say, the usual biomarkers and we keep getting negative results back, we should keep going, because I think every time we receive a negative result, the likelihood of finding a RET fusion increases because this driver does not overlap. I'm talking about treatment-naive patients with other drivers. So I think this is also another very important thing to consider in the real world, in the clinic, that sometimes we don't have access to NGS, or we start by single gene testing for some reason. And I think we need to keep this in mind as well.
And what is also important, because now we are talking about 1 or 2% of our patients, I think it's important that we don't measure only RET. So we are testing also some other rare mutations, like, for example, MET skipping mutation. We are testing also for ROS. We are testing for HER2 mutations, or different other perhaps druggable or non-druggable targets that can get a druggable target in the later times. Also, KRAS G12C mutation is now in the moment getting a druggable target. So it makes sense not to test only one target. It's better to test all targets to have the full information of the patient to decide the right treatment in this situation.
Completely agree. So over to you, Brigitte.
Thank you very much for that fantastic background. Moving on to treatment then, selpercatinib has been reported to show consistent anti-tumor efficacy regardless of the type of prior therapy in clinical trials of patients with RET fusion positive non-small cell lung cancer. Is this discovery likely to have an impact on the way in which selpercatinib is used in these patients? Fernando, would you like to answer that one?
Yes, I think for me, as a pathologist, as a molecular pathologist, for me, the impact is on the biomarker side of things. I'm very convinced that we should test our patients in the very early phase of the workflow. So for me, it has changed because right now I really want to use next generation sequencing as soon as possible upfront and don't wait for single gene testing that, in my opinion, it's sometimes a waste of time and tissue, etc. So what do you think, Max, as a clinician? Because I think your opinion is more important on this question.
So on the one hand, we have the scientific data from the Libretto trial, where we saw that nearly all patients had, in second and also in first line, a clear efficacy of selpercatinib in this trial in terms of remission rate, in terms of PFS, in terms of duration of response. So these patients had a clear better efficacy of giving selpercatinib in this situation, and we can really extend the survival in these patients enormously. It's a drug that you can take two pills in the morning, two pills in the evening, and when you compare it to the traditional chemotherapy, the tolerability of the patient that you can take it at home as an oral drug, also the side effects with a very low rate of grade 3 side effects is much, much better in comparison to the traditional treatment that we would have in the same situation in the older times. So we have the Libretto trial, but we also have our publication recently published with about 50 worldwide patients, where we collected real-world data from 50 patients, where we also could clearly support the data of a clinical trial and put these data in the real-world setting that we clearly have an efficacy on selpercatinib. So these are just published data. And then we have also my personal experience from around more than 15 patients where treated selpercatinib already, where we treat red fusion positive patients with selpercatinib in this setting in a kind of named patient use program, where we could really had a lot of very good experience in patients heavily pretreated or patients with brain metastasis in different lines, where we saw the very good efficacy of these patients. And in from my center, I never had no disease control, so the patients always had a clear efficacy of the drug. And what is really amazing for these patients is that the drug also works in the brain. So, for example, we had a patient with multiple symptomatic brain metastasis. Normally, we would perform a whole brain irradiation, where we know that a whole brain irradiation, especially in palliative care, not leading to a better life quality and normally also not to a better overall survival, but we do it to cover symptoms. And all these patients, just one patient with a lot of brain metastasis and others with some brain metastasis, had a clear efficacy in the brain, leading to a very nice remission, avoiding a whole brain irradiation. And I'm sure it also has a prophylactic effect in the brain. So selpercatinib is doing, based on the published data in real world, based on the prospective trial, a really perfect development for our patients and reflects all identities or all factors that we need in palliative care for our patients. So a really perfect development.
Thank you, Max. That's fantastic news. You've already alluded to the good tolerability with selpercatinib. Could you explain what are the most common treatment emergent adverse events with selpercatinib and pirfenidone, and what can be done to help patients manage these events?
So generally, you take two pills in the morning, two pills in the evening. These are 80 milligrams. And when you have really, there are some rare side effects, but when it's happening, you can adapt a little bit the dosage with the pills. So this is an advantage that you get two pills in the morning, two pills in the evening, to adapt a little bit the dosage. Which side effects can we see? Initially, one third of the patients have a dry mouth. So it's always important that I tell the patient that this can happen. When they know it, they can take a gum or something else to avoid this dry mouth or drink something. But this is something I really see in a lot of patients. Some have an arterial hypertension that they need perhaps some medication to decrease the blood pressure. The dry mouth and also the arterial hypertension are really not a big issue. As an internal medicine physician, it's easy to treat also arterial hypertension, that it's a really difficult problem. I, from my personal perspective, never had it. Sometimes I had to increase a little bit the blood pressure decreaser. Then we have some patients have liver enzyme elevation. This is some happening. You control normally, I take the first blood after 2 to 4 weeks, depending where the patient is living, how he's doing. But then I take the first blood, and then you can see a liver enzyme elevation. When it's necessary, you stop for a short time the drug, and then you start with a lower dosage in this situation. Some patients I saw, especially when the response is in a lot of patients enormously, then, and I think this is something not like a tumor lysis syndrome, but some patients feel dizzy in the beginning when the tumor regresses. So in the first 2, 3, 4 weeks, some patients said they have a little bit of fatigue, feeling a little bit dizzy and tired, but this is something is getting better also in the longer follow-up. And sometimes I had one patient where I had to reduce a little bit the dosage based on the fatigue. And what else? Some patients can develop edema or unspecific gastrointestinal side effects of diarrhea, constipation. But generally, the tolerability, from my personal view, is much, much better in comparison to a chemotherapy. Also, a good tolerability in comparison to immunotherapy. So a drug that really represents all important parameters for a palliative care, and the side effects are easily manageable and a good tolerability.
So that's great news for the patient. Thank you very much, Max. It's been suggested that follow-up data indicating durable anti-tumor efficacy of selpercatinib and prazeltinib highlight the need for RET testing early in the course of disease to identify candidates who may benefit from treatment with these drugs. How would RET testing be conducted in clinical practice? Is the testing feasible, reliable, repeatable, and affordable at the clinical practice level? Fernando, would you like to give your opinion on this?
Yes, thank you. I think right now in most institutions, you have probably two different pathways or workflows when you're organizing your lung cancer biomarker scenario. So option A would be to go for a single gene testing, which now, in my view, is not that popular because there are so many biomarkers that we have to test. Lung cancer samples are usually not very large. In addition to that, we have to look for very different oncogenic mechanisms. We have to look for mutations, but also fusions, sometimes amplifications. So not all methodologies are good for all those different mechanisms. And trying to organize that and release a report in a few days is not that easy. But still, sometimes we need to do that for many reasons, for cost reasons, or because the turnaround time of NGS is just too long, etc. So I think here my only recommendation is to try to make sure that there is a lot of communication between everyone involved in these workflows, meaning that, for example, if a pathologist is looking at the sample at the H&E, we need to make sure that he or she understands that many biomarkers are going to be needed afterwards. So it would be best not to use immunohistochemistry for classification purposes, etc., etc. Also, if the different methodologies are performed in different labs or even in different institutions, there needs to be a lot of communication, very efficient feedback loops in case something goes wrong, etc., etc. So to test for RET, we have, I think, very good break apart FISH probes that, in my opinion, are very reliable. But we also need to understand that in some cases, the separation between the green and the red signals is not going to be huge. So sometimes interpretation can be very, very difficult. In particular, it has been described with some partners, NCOA4 can give very narrow split when using FISH. So we just need to acknowledge that and try to make sure that people reading these assays have a lot of experience looking at fusions. But I still think that FISH can be a very good option because it's cheap, fast, it's available in many, many centers, etc., etc. So that's option A. And many times option A is combined with option B which is upfront NGS. What I mean by that is that sometimes for clinical reasons, you have to start by doing some biomarker testing because the patient just can't wait. But many institutions are now trying to organize upfront NGS testing for all of their advanced lung cancer patients, even if the panels that they are using are not too large. I think the information in lung cancer is good enough, even if the panel is not huge. And in that regard, we just need to make sure, as I said before, that the panel that we are using contains most of the actionable red fusions. And if possible, I always prefer an RNA-based panel, but a DNA-based NGS panel is also excellent, as long as you keep in mind that if the result comes back negative, you need to make sure using RNA that your patient did not have an actionable fusion. So yes, I am very optimistic. I think the technology is improving. Of course, there's more competition, so the prices are going down. So yeah, in short, I would say yes, I think it's feasible, reliable, repeatable, and affordable. But of course, we need to convince more payers, more vendors. Also, probably patients are going to be very helpful in driving this change. So Max, I don't know, what do you think? Do you agree with this optimistic or maybe overly optimistic view?
Fernando, I couldn't add more in this situation. Can just give you how we do it in Austria. We are in a little bit perhaps lucky side in the world. In the moment we test, our pathologists are testing each lung cancer with non-small cell lung cancer immediately on with NGS, independent of the staging. They get the specimen of a non-small cell lung cancer and test it to not lose time. And we do the NGS RNA and DNA based. And this is leading to a good outcome for the patients. And as we know, also like with Adaura, we saw that EGFR mutated patients can get in the adjuvant setting a TKI inhibitor. I'm sure in the near future, we will treat more and more patients with TKIs and also with immunotherapy in the adjuvant, neoadjuvant setting. So it's also a good information to have material to have an NGS test also in earlier stages. And like you said, immediately test helps a lot. I'm a pulmonologist and we are trying to get as much as material for the pathologist, but sometimes we are not perfectly enough. But it's important, without the pathologist, we could not do anything. So it's important to have a good symbiosis between pathologist and clinical physician, with oncologist, pulmonary oncologist in this situation to get the best work done for the patients. And I hand over to Bridget for the next question.
So when should you test for retina patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer? Should it be as early as possible? And would you conduct RET testing for all advanced non-small cell lung cancer patients? It sounds like that's how you're doing it in Austria, Max.
Yeah, this is important that we have the whole information already initially to have it right image, the right view for our patients. And I clearly recommend upfront testing. Perhaps, for example, also KRAS is a marker that we have a label, not now, but we can get it in the named patient use program, the drug. Some other agents, we are able to receive it only in second line, but we know we have something in the later lines. I'm hoping the RET inhibitors will come to first line also. In the moment, we have the label in the second line. But it's also an important information when we know that chemo IO is not working perfectly in these patients. We have already this information to start as soon as possible with the RET inhibitor in this situation. So a clear yes for as soon as possible. Fernando, what do you say from your point?
Completely agree. I think as soon as possible in all patients, looking at a 1 to 2% incidence, we cannot miss a single patient. And as you were saying, if this is organized in a reflex manner without having to trigger testing, is the way to go. So yeah, I completely agree with you.
Thank you both. So the EMA has approved selpercatinib in patients with advanced RET fusion positive non-small cell lung cancer who require systemic therapy following prior treatment with immunotherapy and/or platinum-based chemotherapy. In your opinion, what is the most appropriate first-line treatment for patients with RET fusion positive non-small cell lung cancer?
So we have the label, like you said, and then we have our feeling. And what we saw in our own patients and what we saw also in the Libretto trial, that patients who are receiving chemo immunotherapy or chemo IO, the response to these agents is not as good as we are hoping. And when we compare it to selpercatinib in this situation and also to pralsetinib, we see that these agents are much, much better working in the RET fusion in comparison to chemo IO. On the one hand, we have the label. On the one hand, we have the feeling what we have to do. But in Austria, in the moment, based on the label, we have to go for chemotherapy or chemo IO or IO in this situation. One of these, how is it, what is possible for the patient? And have to have in mind when the patient is progressing, we should start as soon as possible in Austria in the moment. Clearly, selpercatinib, the right way to go. Because we have the label in second line since April 2021.
Please, can you comment on the CNS efficacy of selpercatinib and pralsetinib in RET fusion positive non-small cell lung cancer and its clinical relevance? Max, would you like to contribute to that?
So we have two trials. We have the Libretto trial and we have the ARROW study where we saw that selpercatinib and pralsetinib are penetrating very well into the brain and leading to a nice remission in the brain. Then we have our Siren study published recently, where we saw also from our real-world data that the drug goes into the brain, selpercatinib, and does a really good job there, does a reduction of the diameter of the metastasis. Some also had a complete remission. So in brain metastasis, I clearly recommend to try to avoid whole brain irradiation. You can combine it with stereotactical irradiation. We had some patients where we started with selpercatinib and stereotactical irradiation in this situation, but generally the tolerability is here very good and we see clear remissions from our brain mets and also in the published real-world data. Each patient had a clear remission in line with the Libretto trial and the ARROW study.
Thank you, Max. Fernando, what are your thoughts on the resistance mechanisms to RET-targeted therapy?
First of all, I think if we really want to understand resistance mechanisms in the field of target therapies, in my opinion, we need to try to obtain a re-biopsy because something that we have learned in the past few years is that these resistance mechanisms, not only in the field of RET-targeted therapy, but also for other target therapies as well, are extremely complex, and we are looking at mutations, amplifications, even fusions. So it's best if we can obtain enough tissue. And then my second comment would be to try to use technology that is truly comprehensive, very well validated, etc., etc. So we are looking at next generation sequencing. We should use very reliable options for the same reasons that I mentioned before. Right now, the numbers are still small, but we need to be aware that we'll probably have to look for RET mutations in G810, both S and C, for example, but also we are going to find amplifications in MET, also alterations in KRAS, including amplifications. So again, I think very complex and probably also align what we are finding with other targeted therapies. So back to the methodology, sometimes challenging because, for example, NGS is not currently the best tool to estimate amplification. So if we are using even a very reliable NGS option, it would be best to have access to other methodologies to carry out some orthogonal testing. But I think it's very, very important that we start considering rebiopsies and trying to understand as quickly as possible what are the resistance mechanisms. So Max, what's your take on this?
Thank you, Fernando. So you pointed clearly which points are important. Just I can give just a clinical point of view here. The rebiopsy is always relatively, in some patients, difficult to do it. And the output of the rebiopsy from my small experience of some patients with rebiopsy is very limited. It would be good to know if we get some more information about the resistance mechanism in the situation. But in the moment, out of clinical trial, it's not a must. It's just an academical interest to see. In the moment, unfortunately, we have no specific drug that is known in this situation.
Thank you. On to our final question. Finally, what are the potential effects of these latest developments on clinical practice and patient outcomes? And what does the future of RET-driven non-small cell lung cancer diagnosis and treatment with RET inhibitors look like? Fernando, would you like to go first?
I will go first with the latest developments on clinical practice. I think for me, from a molecular pathologist point of view, and if we look at the whole lung biomarker testing strategy, honestly, the arrival of RET fusions has really changed my approach, because I think right now there are so many biomarkers that you have to test upfront with several therapeutic options per biomarker, even that for me now, it's very, very difficult to continue defending single gene testing. Not that I was very, very optimistic about that option, but now the arrival of RET has, I think, completely convinced even skeptics that we need to try and perform next generation sequencing upfront in a reflex manner in as many patients with advanced lung cancer as we can. So for me, it has changed clinical practice in that way.
So from my side, I can clearly say that the RET fusion is measured since routinely since 1.5 years. RET fusion changed our life completely, and we are treating already patients since summer 2019 with selpercatinib. And this makes, so it's a real practice changing that we have now also the approval of selpercatinib in second line. Before it was without an approval in the named patient use program. So the RET fusion is a clear advances and a practice changing information in the NGS report, because we really have here a druggable target that is rare but can be treated relatively easy with these pills. I hand over to Bridget again.
Thank you both. That was an absolutely fascinating discussion of the latest developments in RET-driven lung cancer. Thank you, Max and Fernando, very much for your interesting insights into this complex topic.
Thank you very much again. And it was really nice talking to you, Brigitte and Max.
Thank you very much. Buenos dias. Dankeschön, Ron von Wien. It was great to have this great session and this podcast together. All the best. Dankeschön.
And that concludes our podcast on a summary of the latest findings in RET-driven lung cancer presented at ASCO 2021 virtual conference. A big thank you to our host, Dr. Bridget Scott, and our two experts, Dr. Maximilian Hochmeier and Dr. Fernando Lopez-Rios, for sharing their thoughts and insight. If you enjoyed this episode, please head over to our podcast hub at www.emg-health.com. Read that again, www.emg-health.com, where we have plenty of other episodes like this, as well as over 50 interviews with leading voices from all corners of healthcare. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.